This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. So everything's big in the Olympics, right? From 6'4" Michael Phelps and his 28 medals to the height of Simone Biles' tumbling passes. They're all big. Except this is the story about the little guys. Guys like Brian Gleason, vice president of a supplement company called Provenex.
We're a small company, still fairly new, about 2.5, 3 years old.
So you can understand why, when 5 athletes sponsored by Provenex qualified for Rio, Gleason was pretty excited.
I hadn't done anything in the Olympic space yet, so I was not aware of Rule 40, neither was our CEO.
But back in June, Gleason and his CEO were at a beach volleyball tournament in New York when an agent sat them down and explained the bad news.
We were kind of like, whoa, wait, what? You know, we had all these grand plans.
So what is this grand plan destroying Rule 40?
Yeah, so Rule 40 is the IOC rule where brands that are not official sponsors, you're not allowed to use any of the Olympic trademark words or phrases. You can't say Olympic. You can't say Olympian. You can't say, Road to Rio.
Also, medals, games, performance, victory, and summer. Yes, the IOC has banned any commercial entity, not one of its 11 official sponsors, from mentioning summer during the Olympic blackout period, from a few days before the games until a few days after the closing ceremonies. Mention any of the words in ads or on social media, and you just might receive a cease and desist letter from the USOC.
I mean, it's pretty extensive. I was kind of surprised. We're not even allowed to, for instance, like retweet a tweet from Team USA.
After the initial shock wore off, Gleason and his team sat down and tried to figure out ways to let people know about their 5 athletes in Rio without mentioning their 5 athletes in Rio.
You know, we sent out a tweet that was, wishing best of luck to unnamed volleyball player who will be playing at 1 p.m. in Brazil. Go get him, unnamed athlete.
This is pretty common. Ad executives at Ford reportedly brainstormed words they could use that weren't banned. They came up with fit, active, and strong. It hasn't always been like this. The rules used to be a lot more relaxed. And then this happened.
A call has gone forth from Olympic Stadium for the man who would be king.
Michael Johnson was the it athlete of the 1996 games in Atlanta.
For the man who would dare challenge Mercury, golden wings on his feet.
Johnson was signed by Nike, but Reebok was the official sponsor. So Nike came up with a plan centered around a pair of $30,000 racing spikes. NBC ate it all up, cutting from the obligatory Michael Johnson fluff piece to a live shot of those shoes at the starting line of the 400-meter final.
Wearing shoes of gold, the man who would be king, Michael Johnson, Waco, Texas.
So Michael Johnson in the golden shoes created the rules that we have today. It really kind of changed the face of Olympic marketing at that point.
That's Joe Favorito, sports marketing consultant and professor at Columbia University.
Bright, bright shoes. Not only that, there was an entire kind of guerrilla marketing plan that was built around it to drive attention to what they were doing without ever saying that Michael Johnson was participating in the Olympics and they were an Olympic sponsor.
Nike also gave fans free Nike flags that they could wave around for the cameras. Favorito says he thought the campaign was brilliant. The IOC didn't agree, and neither did Reebok, the company that had paid for the official sponsorship.
And now what I think you see is the IOC and the USOC taking even more steps to make sure that people really can't do the kind of guerrilla things that you could do before.
But where does that leave the little guys, the ones who can't afford the $150 to $200 million it takes to be an official Olympic sponsor?
The problem I have is it's where they drew the line. It just, to not be able to talk about the games or use the word summer in a post, I mean, It's too much.
That's Michael Kaplan, and he's the co-owner of a carpet cleaning company in Minneapolis.
We're a lifestyle company, and our social presence is all about community and current events and, of course, carpet cleaning.
So when something cool is going on at the local arts center, Kaplan's company tweets about it. When people are debating which is the best burger in town, his company weighs in. And Kaplan thought the same would be true come the Olympics.
We weren't going to have a gold medal carpet cleaning special. We just thought it's part of what people are talking about. People are obsessed about it, and for good reason. And we had an expectation that we would be part of that conversation at a very local level.
Kaplan doesn't have a lot of followers on Twitter. At last check, he had 269.
I would say that we are big for the carpet cleaning world, but we're just a tiny little thing in the sea of commerce.
But whether a company has 200 Twitter followers or 2 million, the rules are the rules.
We wouldn't even be able to congratulate any of the 11 Minnesotans in the games. To me, that really hit a nerve. It felt yucky, to use a very grown-up word. It felt yucky.
Why not just do what everyone else does and kind of skirt the rules and make do?
We got a bug up our butt. We got frustrated, and it would have been easy to sit on the sidelines, but we really felt that it's just wrong. It feels so contrary to what the Olympics are about. I'm not the guy who watches every event, but I love it. I mean, it's a chance to escape and kind of remember our humanity. It's a chance to get away from the political conversations and the conversations about ISIS and terrorism. And there's so much going on in the world today. It's easy to be cynical. I was sick of being cynical. It seemed like an opportunity to step up and try and do the right thing.
So Kaplan sued, saying his company's First Amendment rights had been trampled. He says he's not looking for a paycheck. He's not claiming that his company's profits have been damaged in any way. He just wants a court of law to offer clarification on whether the IOC and USOC really can keep him from tweeting the word summer during 3 weeks of the summer. And yes, he knows that his company is very, very small, and the people he's up against are very, very big.
Fortunately, it's not about how many attorneys you have on your team. I'm sure that they have many, many, many. We have smart people, and we think that the law's on our side. People who are law professors and state senators and people in the legal world, I'm not going to say that every voice has said, yeah, this makes sense, but overwhelmingly, what I've seen is that people really believe that this is an overreach by the USOC and that it's a big deal. It's bigger than us. Yeah, we're tiny relative to the USOC, this monster body. But I don't think in this type of circumstance that really matters.
Kaplan says his lawyers and the USOC are currently sparring over technicalities. He's not sure if that's a delaying tactic or just how these things work. And he knows that his lawsuit came too late for Rio 2016. But Pyeongchang 2018 is just around the corner, and winter is on the list of banned words. Commentator Mike Pesca has a lesson in Olympic metallurgy.
Go for the gold, but if you don't get the gold, go for the bronze? That does seem to be the lesson. Here's U.S. swimmer Nathan Adrian, who had just lost not to one but two other swimmers. Or as he looked at it, he won the bronze.
It actually felt pretty good, to be honest. But certainly think, you know, I can't be upset with that. I just came with a bronze medal.
Whereas silver medalists, well, listen to these door rowers from the 2012 games, Great Britain's Hunter and Purchase.
It's kind of a roller coaster of emotions at the moment. One minute we feel okay and then we feel quite down because we came here to win, and unfortunately our best performance wasn't good enough today. And you know, but that's sport and that's what makes it special.
They were 6/10 of a second behind the winning Danes. All that rowing can lead to ruin. And like I said, studies show bronze medalists feel happy to get a medal but silver medalists regret not winning gold. In 1995, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology had three researchers who looked at pictures and listened to interviews of the 1992 Olympics and decided that silver medalists seemed sadder than the bronze medalists. That was it. That was their research. Not exactly double-blind peer review studies, which is the gold standard, but we're not talking about the gold standard. We're talking about bronze, just good enough. So I replicated their efforts. During the entirety of the Rio Games, I have been studying silver and bronze medalists, looking at their faces, analyzing their comportment. And I found a rule more subtle than just silver is sadder than bronze. I find it depends on the circumstance. Here's Ireland's Annalise Murphy, who won a silver in sailing.
It's amazing. It's actually really heavy. it's a dream come true. You dream about these kinds of moments, but you never actually think they're going to happen to you. So, yeah, I'm just over the moon. I just can't believe it. I probably will wear this to bed.
Murphy was third entering the final day and moved up to second. That's important. I found that athletes who aren't really close to first, but just edge out third place, are really, really happy to win silver. American Evan Jagger was thrilled to silver in the steeplechase. And did you see the American women who swept the podium in the 100-meter hurdles? They were all giddy. Even silver medalist Nia Ali. I also think it matters how much you lose by. If you're slightly outdone, if you're pipped at the end, you rue and you stew. But where the first place finisher is leagues ahead, the silver medalist seems to get happier. I looked up a couple examples from rowing in the 2012 games, and this was striking. Rower after rower who earned silver but were soundly beaten for gold seemed really happy. Take the women's eight. In the women's eight, the United States is the dominant boat. It's been that way since Beijing. So it's really just a race for second place. This year, the English women silvered, and they celebrated like they won second, not lost first. In London, the Canadian women won second, and they were thrilled, as were the Canadian men. Listen to this sterling silver medalist, Malcolm Howard.
It's amazing. I mean, it's not just about the end goal, but it's about the story, and that's the best story I've ever had in rowing.
He still beat the bronze. There is no shame in silver. It still shines pretty brightly in the sun, thereby proving that all that glitters is not gold.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. There's a lot more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Karen Given. This week in Rio, Michael Phelps taught Katie Ledecky how to arrange all her medals for a Sports Illustrated cover shoot.
All right, okay.
Done it before.
Right. You'll learn, don't worry about it.
How many gold medals are enough gold medals? That's coming up on this week's Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me this time around are the Boston Globe's Shira Springer and David Steele of The Sporting News. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Shira, we're going to start with you, and I understand that it's not gold medals, but the places where gold medals are won and lost that's on your mind.
Yeah, I'm down here in Rio, and I am hoping the IOC realizes it's time to seriously, seriously, seriously consider permanent host cities for the Summer and Winter Games. Pick four or five summer cities and four or five winter cities and rotate through them. Rio was not ready to host the Olympics. From a murky diving pool that took 6 days to return to normal, to buses that never showed up, or that, in one instance, accidentally took swimmers to the track and field stadium, to garbage in the water affecting sailing results, problems have really plagued these games. And, you know, there's always a steep learning curve when it comes to hosting the largest, most complex sports competition in the world. Permanent hosts could build on their own experiences, reuse venues, and create a smoother, more organized games. And it would be better for the athletes, for fans, and honestly, IOC, if you're listening, probably for the Olympic brand, too.
You know, I would add to that list that Shira just ran off. I think the residents of a lot of these cities would benefit greatly, too. So I definitely get why that would be a good idea.
Yeah, it is a move that has wisdom and practicality, but I just don't see it as happening. I guess I'm just a cynic on this. I think nothing is going to change until the IOC opens up the bidding for the games and nobody applies. And unfortunately, there's always North Korea. Someone is always going to apply. Shira, am I wrong about this?
Well, I really do believe that they're going to think long and hard about some serious changes. There were two bidders for the Winter Olympics in 2022. So while there may, we haven't reached the zero point, we're pretty darn close to it.
Okay, my topic is also Olympics related, and I don't have an answer, but maybe one of you do. The question is there even such a thing as enough gold medals anymore? It used to be that one was enough, but now with Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky and Simone Biles, we've set the bar even higher. I mean, take the headline that ran this week. You've probably seen it on social media in big letters. You've got Michael Phelps ties for silver in 100 fly, and then in smaller letters, Ledecky sets world record in women's 800 freestyle. And a lot of people see this as gender discrimination, and maybe it is, but it is also the fact that one gold medal isn't enough for us anymore, or in Michael Phelps' case, 23 gold medals isn't enough for us anymore. We need him to win them all. Where does this come from, and is there any way for us to dial it back?
That horse really might be out of the barn, and
I'm right there with you, David.
Padlocked. No, this is our nature. I mean, this is what we do. We're, you know, one is not enough, 12 is not enough, 23 is not enough. This Olympiad might have been the tipping point for a lot of these things. I mean, you mentioned Simone Biles. The flip side mm-hmm. of that is Gabby Douglas.
Right.
You know, I mean, this was like a torturous Olympic experience for her, and she was part of a gold medal winning team for the second time.
Yeah, we're not a nation that does the whole scale back thing well. We are a nation that loves gold medals, and we like winning a lot of them. To me, some of the best stories and most interesting moments have actually been a pair of silver medal winners down here. When Jevi Stone won silver in the women's single sculls, and it was a complete shock to her to get that medal, and she was overjoyed. Same thing with Daryl Homer when he won a silver in saber fencing. But I love the athletes who cherish their one medal, whatever color it is.
All right, David, take us away from Rio, will you?
Yeah, far, far from it, as a matter of fact. back to our old friends in the NFL. Speaking of completely unchecked, out-of-control power, Roger Goodell and the NFL, they're investigating the report on Al Jazeera about performance-enhancing drug use, particularly HGH, among several players. One of them was Peyton Manning. He retired, and his name was eventually cleared. But four other players were named in the report. The NFL has made an incredibly long investigation out of it and now has told those four players that if they do not speak to the league, they will be suspended. The player's initial reaction was, you can't do that. And the NFL said, well, that's too bad. We have the right to do that. It is right here in the collective bargaining agreement, the conduct detrimental to the game clause, which is what was used several other times. It's just the latest of many, many, many examples of the power that the NFL is just abusing now. And it's another fight that the NFL has picked with the players that may end up resulting in something severe like a work stoppage when the next time the labor agreement comes up 5 years from now.
You're absolutely right, David. I mean, this is going to go on and on and on unless there is a work stoppage. I mean, it seems like it's the only way at this point to curb the power of the commissioner and the league. Otherwise, Goodell and the other powers that be are going to keep putting on pressure on players using the conduct detrimental clause to get what they want.
what would happen if the players walked out over these policies? I mean, New England fans are really quick to say that, you know, Goodell shouldn't be judge, jury, and executioner on Deflategate. But if the players really took a stand and stopped going to work, would the media and the fans really stand behind them? Or would we say, hey, if you do bad things, you should be punished?
Historically, the fans have always lined up behind the league and the owners when it comes to things like strikes and lockouts. Now, right now, there's been probably a bigger shift in that than maybe there ever has been either in the NFL or any other sport. Fans really, really hate Goodell. It's really across the board, and they really hate the power. They're at the point where in a nation that, you know, they hate the Patriots, they hate Bill Belichick, they hate Tom Brady.
It's true.
Yet, they sympathize with him right now. They are behind him. They say it's unfair. The NFL sort of looking at all of this and saying, hey, they'll always come back. They love us. But this will be the ultimate test of that.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been the Boston Globe's Shira Springer and David Steele of The Sporting News. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, so maybe this has happened to you. An Olympic swimmer gets out of a pool, or maybe an archer pulls back a bow. You catch a glimpse of five interlocking rings on a back or an inner arm or a thigh, and you think, nice tat. No? Well, it's happened to me. Olympic rings tattoos aren't for everyone. In fact, if you ask most Olympians, they're only for people who have actually competed in the actual Olympics. That's what makes them so special. But as we get ready to say goodbye to Rio 2016, people are starting to think about the very complicated future of Olympic tattoos 4 years from now in Tokyo 2020. But let's start with the present.
My name's Long Gutierrez. I'm a swimmer here at Cal Berkeley. And so I just basically went to the Olympics for the 100 butterfly.
Long Gutierrez was born in Mexico, but his parents moved him to the U.S. when he was two so that he could pursue a career in swimming. He's been dreaming about the Olympics for a long time. He remembers the moment. He was watching the Olympics on TV. Maybe it was Beijing in 2008. And he saw a swimmer. Maybe it was Ryan Lochte with an Olympic ring tattoo on his arm. Even though Long can't quite remember the details, that moment left an impression.
I just thought it was the coolest thing ever, and I remember going to my mom and my dad just like saying, when I make it, that's what I'm gonna get.
To everyone's surprise, Long's parents agreed. His mom told him it was the only tattoo she'd ever be okay with.
It was super funny because before then, like, they would never even like thought of me getting a tattoo or just like even letting me. And so I don't know, it's like ever since then, I've always like been kind of striving towards that.
Long qualified to swim for Mexico at the Rio Olympics way back in August of 2015. So he had a long time to imagine his Olympic experience. And he didn't picture the opening ceremonies or standing on the blocks for his first race.
It was kind of weird, but I was more excited about coming back and getting the tattoo than like the experience.
Long's dad died a few years ago. He'll never get to see his son get that tattoo. And his mom couldn't go to Rio to see him compete because of some last-minute health worries. But now that Long is back in the States, she knows what's coming next. Now that it's really here, has your mom changed her mind at all?
So before I left for Rio, I was talking to her and I was just like, Mom, I hope you know no matter what you say, I'm still going to get this tattoo. And she was just like, yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so how did we get here to this place where Olympians are looking forward more to the tattoos than the games? And otherwise tattoo-hating mothers are saying, yeah, that's fine when their sons and daughters decide to get inked.
The first time I ever saw a tattoo that made me think of the rings were on a swimmer who's now deceased, Victor Davis of Canada, and he had the maple leaf on his chest.
That's Chris Jacobs. He won two golds and a silver at the 1988 Seoul Games, but he's best remembered as the first known U.S. swimmer to get an Olympic rings tattoo. And it all started with that maple leaf tattoo on the chest of Canadian Victor Davis.
Although I did think that something sort of that size ended up looking like a third nipple. So it was always an odd place for a tattoo, in my opinion.
So I was picturing a really big maple leaf, but apparently if it was nipple-sized, it wasn't.
Just about that size.
That nipple-sized maple leaf understandably made an impression. But Chris wasn't a stranger to ink. He already had a Texas Longhorn tattoo on his hip, and that one had a story, too.
I was with a couple teammates, and they had all backed out at the last second after I had mine done.
So Chris found himself alone in the chair, looking up at the guy who'd just finished his tattoo.
And then I said, do I need to keep this thing dry? He's like, yes, you can't get it wet for at least 10 days.
This was a problem. Chris had another pool session scheduled for later that day.
And so I panicked and had to come up with some sort of illness that my coach would find believable. I think he just looked at me and groaned and, you know, let me know that he wasn't particularly happy and that I really needed to have a speedy recovery and get right back in and start training again. And I think after about 3 days, I just put lots of ointment on it and Band-Aids and swam with it after that.
That tattoo was completely hidden. Before he had it done, Chris put on his swimsuit and marked the skin it covered, just to be sure. And after having a great time at the 1988 Olympics and seeing that nipple-sized maple leaf tattoo, Chris had another idea.
I decided it would be fun to commemorate it by putting the little ring somewhere on my body.
So he did. At first, he added a small set of rings to the Longhorn tattoo hidden under his swimsuit. But since he was out of excuses to miss practice, that one faded pretty quickly. So it's the much larger Olympic rings tattoo under his right upper arm that he added years later that Chris is well known for, famous for, really. But while people like me call him up every 4 years to talk about it, when Chris was working on Wall Street, he took care to wear sleeves long enough to cover it.
On hot summer days, although our trading desk is always super air-conditioned, when I sort of start feeling tired, I would always lean back in my chair and stick my arms up and catch myself. And most of the people I worked with knew that I had been in the Olympics, but most of them didn't know anything about the tattoo.
Long Gutierrez isn't worried about keeping his rings covered. He says these days, having an Olympic tattoo makes you part of a club that people want to be in. But he might be in for a surprise when he gets to Japan for the 2020 Games.
So if you're getting a tattoo in Japan, it's not like in the West where it's like, oh, I'm going to go get a tattoo. It's a lifestyle change.
That's Brian Ashcraft. He's an American living in Japan, and he's written a book about the history of tattoos there. He says in Japan, most people keep their tattoos hidden for fear of discrimination.
Doing something like getting a bank loan or at a job application become almost impossible in many cases. So tattoos traditionally in Japan are designed to be covered, whereas tattoos in the West are often, you know, you kind of show them off.
Tattooing in Japan might date back all the way to the 3rd century. At times, tattoos were used to brand criminals or courtesans. But tattoos were also used as talismans by fishermen and laborers to protect them from danger. Then, in the late 19th century, Japan started interacting more with the Western world.
And as more and more foreigners came into Japan, I think that the country's elite, the leaders, felt like, well, we don't want to portray ourselves as primitive or backward because we're not. Well, we need to, like, put our best foot forward.
And some people thought an inkless foot or arm or stomach was the way to go.
From the late 19th century until after World War II, tattooing was outlawed. I mean, it was banned. And the police would go after tattooers and they'd take away their pattern books.
And you know that old saying, outlaw tattooing and only outlaws get tattoos.
And so during this period of time, the people who were employing tattooers were gangsters. So they kept this kind of, you know, folk art or artistic tradition alive.
Tattoos became legal again in 1948. But by then, they were mostly associated with one group, the Yakuza. Japanese organized crime. If you watch movies, you've probably heard of them.
This is a Yakuza outfit I'm dealing with. What the hell can the police do?
But what will happen in 4 years when more than 10,000 athletes, many of them inked, arrive in Tokyo for the Games?
For the upcoming Olympics, I think that this will just be another opportunity for people in Japan to kind of slowly separate the stereotype that they have for tattoos, that tattoos are bad or tattoos are connected to crime.
Brian says he hopes Olympic athletes will understand that any bad behavior will reflect not only on them, their countries, and the Olympics, but also on every other tattooed person in Japan.
So often, like, the news here, if somebody gets arrested, they'll be like, oh, this guy's tattoos, you know, or they'll find a picture of him somewhere and like showing off his tattoos or something like that. And they're like, see, tattoos are bad, Japan.
Which means if you happen to tell the media a story about being robbed at gunpoint by police, and that story turns out to be less than truthful, it's not your blue-green hair that's going to be splashed across the front pages of newspapers. It'll be your Olympic tattoo. Yes, Ryan Lochte, I'm talking to you. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Next week on Only a Game, how an Indianapolis school teacher slash Oklahoma City Thunder fan dissed Kevin Durant and became the envy of his colleagues.
One was pretty mad. She goes, I've been trying to go viral for years, and you're here for a week and put up one little poster and all of a sudden you're famous.
I'm Karen Given. Coming up on Only a Game, taking on poverty and gangs in Detroit, one hook, cross, and jab at a time. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Accusing the Brazilian police of a crime that they apparently did not commit is a very bad idea. That's the lesson Ryan Lochte and three of his fellow Olympic swimmers learned this week after apparently damaging a gas station door and being confronted by security guards who wanted them to pay up. What do you make of this brouhaha?
No, I think brouhaha, emphasis on the first syllable, is probably where we're at here. Ryan Lochte's an oaf. But I have to admit, this really makes me wonder about the loyalty of athletes' moms. We hear a lot of great things about athletes' moms, but it was Lochte's mom who spread the story about how the Brazilian police had robbed him of his wallet, but mysteriously not his watch. And, you know, guys, even in Rio de Janeiro, there are surveillance cameras. You're always on camera now, everywhere you go.
And if your hair is bright green, they're going
to
find you.
That's a very good point. It's going to be very hard to explain that it's not you.
Carrie Walsh Jennings will take home the beach volleyball bronze along with teammate April Ross. They were expected to compete for gold. Walsh Jennings is widely recognized as the greatest U.S. female volleyballer of all time, but now she's gotten a bronze. So loser, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I watched the American women's beach volleyball team and the American women's indoor volleyball team, both of whom were upset. The women's volleyball team was upset by Serbia, and of course, the American women's beach volleyball team were upset by Brazil, which once again, charmingly, only uses their first names. They were beaten by Barbara and Agatha. But they came back and won the bronze, and I mean, she's been doing this an awfully long time. Yeah. I think one bronze among the golds isn't that bad.
Argentina's Manu Ginobili and France's Tony Parker have played in their last Olympics, Charlie. Both countries have been eliminated. Maybe the opportunity for each to add a fifth NBA ring with the San Antonio Spurs will console them.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Parker's 34, Ginobili's 39. If they want to maintain their NBA careers, which apparently they do, and apparently the Spurs want them to, this is probably the smart move. Particularly for Ginobili, this has to be tough because he's part of that great generation of Argentina's basketball program that is now passing from the stage, and he's the linchpin of it. But they will be back and contributing, I'm sure, to Coach Pop this year.
German Olympic runners Anna and Lisa Honner are twins. They finished last Sunday's women's marathon in 81st and 82nd place, and they caught a lot of grief about it. Why?
Because they finished hand in hand, and the Germans went bananas. The Germans said it was treating the Olympic marathon like, quote, a fun run. You know what? When you're in 81st place, it is a fun run. I keep hearing about, you know, the main thing about the Olympics is not winning, but taking part. Okay, they were taking part.
Irish bantamweight Michael Conlan has accused amateur boxing officials of corruption. Wait, boxing? Corrupt?
First of all, I love Michael Conlan because if you watch that fight and then watch his reaction to the very, very bizarre decision he was handed, Michael Conlan put up the international sign for disapproval, which is the famous double bird, to all corners of the arena. I think he was just aiming it at the judges, but it was an epic way to leave the ring and leave your Olympic career. And he did indeed get robbed.
NBC has been criticized for, well, pretty much everything related to how they have covered these games. Is it any worse than usual, or are we all just getting grumpier?
I think we're all getting grumpier. I think the availability of all the sports in real time on your telephone, which is basically the way I've watched most of the Olympics, is really cutting in. And they've been doing televised Olympics for so long that almost everything is a cliche. You can't avoid, I mean, outside of the individual stories of the athletes, which are told in basically the same way every 4 years, there's not much else you can do.
The Paralympics will begin on September 7th in Rio. The event has received a $46 million taxpayer bailout after organizers failed to come up with the necessary funding from private sources. Some say the solution is to combine the Olympics and the Paralympics. What does Charlie Pierce say?
I don't think that's a solution because as long as you've got cities bidding for these things, you're going to wind up with the Paralympics getting all jumbled up in the actual Olympic monster. They will lose their sense of identity almost immediately. Once again, the basic solution to this whole problem is to fire all the corrupt bagmen who are in the IOC, build a permanent site. I've suggested Omaha. I don't think there's any reason why they can't be in Omaha every 4 years. And then allow the organizing bodies for the Olympics and the Paralympics to do their own business in their own way.
Clemson quarterback Deshaun Watson is asking us to stop calling him a dual threat. He says that's code for a racial stereotype. What do you think?
I think he's right, and I'm glad he called it out. And I think the more athletes who do that and the more athletes become aware of it, the better we'll be at covering them.
MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred is reportedly alarmed by the game's lack of action this season and is considering what some say would be the most radical rule changes to the game since 1889. Because, you know, it's not like tradition matters in baseball or anything.
You know what, though? I love all of these. I mean, I mean, curtailing the number of pitching changes in a game, Tony La Russa's head will explode all over his ballet school T-shirt. 20-second time clocks for pitchers I've advocated for years because it will eliminate Clay Buchholz's, you know, dark night of the soul every time he decides whether or not he's going to hang a slider or hang a curveball. Good for Rob Manfred. I hope he gets at least half of these through.
And finally, Charlie, I feel very badly that I didn't give you the chance to yell your favorite word last week. So go ahead.
Sports!
Well done. Anyway, most people know that Ernest Hemingway was a hunter. So was Hunter S. Thompson. This week, the late writer's stories intersected in an interesting way. What happened?
Apparently, at one point during his very lively career, Hunter stole a pair of antlers from Ernest Hemingway's home. And, you know, both of them have now passed along to the great Gonzo Writer's Workshop in the sky. And Hunter's family have returned the antlers to the Hemingways, which I think is a really nice way to attain closure.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
When I was a kid, I loved watching the Rocky movies from the top of my parents' Suburban at the local drive-in. I always cheered when Rocky came back from the brink of defeat. As an adult, I can't bring myself to watch the sport, not even in the Olympics, where boxing has theoretically, though not completely, been cleaned up. I know too much about the damage caused by repeated blows to the head, and I just don't enjoy watching humans inflict pain on other humans. But even with all the power boxing has to harm bodies, the sport also has the power to heal communities. Detroit is a community in need of healing. Nearly 40% of Detroiters live below the poverty line, and for years it was considered the most violent city in the country. One boxer is trying to change that. Here's Eilish O'Neill.
Kelly Sweeney and I are standing in front of an abandoned house.
On this street, it was like a dirt road street. I thought it was the only dirt road street left in Detroit.
The house's windows are boarded up, its roof crumbling, and its door falling in. It's tiny, just one small floor and an attic. It's the only house left on the block across the street from the Strong Steel plant. Tall grasses and weeds grow where other houses once stood.
Can't believe this house is still here.
This house was Callie's childhood home.
My biological mother, she dealt with drug addiction her whole adult life. Cleanliness is not the top priority, and responsibility is not a top priority. So I've been left in houses, in my own diapers and trash, knee high.
While Callie tells me his story, trucks keep coming in and out of the steel plant across the street.
A child didn't fit into that lifestyle, so she ended up giving me to some fine people in the neighborhood.
It was an informal adoption. It didn't involve any paperwork. Callie's adopted family included parents, aunts and uncles, and cousins. It was this adopted family that taught Callie how to box. Two of his cousins were good enough boxers to go pro, he says, but their careers were cut short. One by high blood pressure, and the other because he landed in prison.
And in this house right here that we're standing in front of, they would start at that corner down there, my cousins, and they would run 5 miles around this whole plant right here. I would get up and go run with them too. Then they would shadow box. And
boxing was a welcome escape from everything else in Callie's life. His biological family was splintered. His mother was in and out of the picture. His brother was being raised by his grandmother across town. And Callie struggled in school.
In the third grade, I realized I couldn't read and write. Before you know it, I was in the 11th grade. Still never learned how to read and write. Never.
So Callie dropped out of school.
I had nothing going for myself. I had no education. If I can cut some grass somewhere, or somebody was painting a house or something, pretty much a bum, asking other people for handouts, basically. I was in the street life, the street culture. You're talking about running with gangs. You're hanging out with some pretty shady characters.
I asked Callie if he was involved in any drug dealing, and he made faces at the microphone. What he did tell me was that during this part of his life, his early 20s, he was basically jobless and homeless. One day, he visited his older brother's house, and his brother pulled out a photo taken when Callie was a teenager.
It was all of my friends. We were going to go skating in Pontiac, Michigan. And so it was like 30 guys in front of my house or more. He's like, he's dead. He's dead. He's in jail. He's in jail. Life, dead. Life, on the run. They looking for him. I'm like, wow. Then I started thinking like, man, I have to change my life.
Callie went back to school and got a steady job in construction. He saved up enough money that he could stop bouncing around and started renting a hotel room by the week. Then he turned and looked back at the neighborhood he'd come from.
So then I started thinking to myself, like, if somebody would have got to me when I was young and would have got to most of my friends when they were young, they wouldn't have went through what they went through. They wouldn't have went to prison. They wouldn't have been killed at an early age, or they wouldn't have been, you know what I mean? So I said, let's start talking to the young guys. So that's when I started thinking, how can I get these young guys' attention? What do I know how to do that I can help these guys?
Callie started teaching a couple of kids how to box in a park near his house. But you can only learn so much by shadow boxing. They needed a gym, so Callie signed a lease. He tried to make ends meet by selling boxing lessons to adults so he could teach the kids for free. But he wasn't bringing in enough cash. So he moved out of his house and into his car, and he used his own money to pay the rent. After that, he sold his car, and he started sleeping in the gym. He was willing to make all those sacrifices to help the kids avoid what he'd been through.
I was given chance after chance after chance. I was sitting in a car that got shot 26 times and only got shot one time and lived. I was standing on the side of a house, and a guy shot 30-something rounds from an assault rifle, and I didn't get hit, and everything behind me was shot all up. My life is here for a purpose, and I know it.
Callie's purpose isn't just teaching kids how to box. He also feeds them an after-school snack when they arrive and dinner before they leave. For some of them, it's their only meal of the day. And he has tutors on hand to help the kids with their schoolwork, which they have to finish before they're allowed to box.
These kids are so much like me. It's unbelievable. I had kids in there who couldn't read. I had kids in there who hadn't eaten. I had kids in there who had serious life problems going on.
But when Callie asked potential donors for money, he didn't talk about those life problems, his or the kids'. He just said he was providing a safe space for kids after school. That's why, even with all his sacrifices, Callie was running out of money and knew that soon he'd have to close the gym.
Because I didn't know how to tell a story, you know what I mean? Because I thought it was like me, when you don't read and write, or you're having trouble with schoolwork, that, you kind of hide that. I thought you were supposed to hide that. So I was never telling anybody about that. I was like, oh, we just got a boxing gym.
That's where Jessica Hauser comes in. In 2010, she came by the gym to take boxing lessons from Callie and saw everything that was happening.
She's like, no, this is something special. She's like, you're feeding kids. That is special. You need to tell people about that. You know, don't hide that.
It was Jessica Hauser who got together the paperwork so the gym could be a nonprofit. She helped with fundraising, and eventually she became the downtown boxing gym's executive director. Today, 120 kids come here every day after school to learn how to box. After they jump rope and run laps, Kelly spars with them one at a time, helping them improve their form. There are girls and boys here, 7-year-olds and 17-year-olds, native Detroiters and immigrants.
Sitting over there behind the weights, behind the leg press.
Since Coach Callie founded the gym in 2007, Detroit's high school graduation rate has been between 55 and 75%. But every kid who's been through the downtown boxing gym has graduated from high school. Callie says it doesn't just take tutoring. He also has to convince kids they have a future to look forward to.
People used to always say to me, you fight so much that, man, you're going to be dead or in jail before you're 21. So when they said that to me, I'm like, I took that as a pass to go crazy. You just gave me nothing to live for. I will never tell a kid that, ever. Instead of saying, hey, son, you're going down the wrong path. Let's make some lifestyle adjustments and get you going in the right direction.
Getting the kids going in the right direction is really, really tough.
I mean, we've actually had rival gang members in the same gym. And so we tell them off the top, this is a neutral zone. I'll partner those guys together. This guy, he's your partner. He's your training buddy right now. It's either my way or no way. You know, I might can't control what goes on in your neighborhood, but I can control what's going on here. And then you'll see those guys, after so long of working with each other and partnering with each other, you see that gang thing start to fade away.
As a result, kids trust him. 17-year-old Vanell Johnson calls Coach Callie and Jessica Hauser whenever he has a problem.
We got that bond, like, how your dad can get on you and, like, yell at you and stuff. Callie do the same thing. Jessica do the same thing. We respect them, and we go do what they say. I could look at him like as a father figure because Callie go be on my head. V, you got to do this, you got to do that. If I need something, I could call and ask. It's like, that's my dad. Like, I could really call him dad. I could call Jessica mom.
Callie says he never gets tired of working with the kids, but fundraising can be a real drag. The program is free for all participants, so he relies on donations to pay himself and his staff, to keep the lights on, and to feed the kids. When things get too hard, he leaves the gym and gets in his car, and he drives here, to the house where he grew up.
For me, when I see this house, stay grounded to my roots. Still, to me, I'm still a guy from that dirt road street. I'm still a guy who, you know, sat on the porch and listened to the blues. Anytime that I feel like, just giving up, I sometimes come back and I look at this house and sit here and I just get my mind right and stay focused.
For Only a Game, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ian Foster. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from swimmer Long Gutierrez, who says he's not nervous about getting his first tattoo.
I'm like good with pain, so I'm not too worried about it. But I mean, we'll see.
Huh. Olympian. Good with pain. Imagine that. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield will be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.